I invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 1. Our scripture reading this morning will be verses 1 through 13. And we'll be looking at the second and third days of creation. We'll begin at verse 1. And now hear the word of God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And so the evening and the morning were the first day. And then God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And so the evening and the morning were the second day. And then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And so the evening and the morning were the third day. And we'll end our reading there. It seems that everywhere you look today in our world and in our culture, the theory of evolution, Big Bang Theory, are just accepted or granted. You turn on the television or open a science textbook in a school, and these things are pretty much assumed by the general population. And they seem to have the expertise of science on their side. Now, in an atmosphere like that, it seems that the average Christian who believes in Genesis chapter 1 may be made to feel a bit naive. It is only said that the latest and greatest, the cutting-edge technology of science can explain the origins of our world, and not some 3,000-year-old story about God. And so Genesis 1 is thought to be some ancient fable, nothing that modern man should take seriously. But 1 Corinthians chapter 1 reminds us that the foolishness of God is wiser than man. That what comes from God, that which men deem foolish, is more wise than all the wisdom of the world. And so as we study Genesis chapter 1, it's important to bear this in mind. The world may call it foolish. The world may call us naive for believing it. But this is the truth about our origins. It is not a tale of billions of years and the power of chance. Nor does it include vast statistics and scientific formulas. Instead, it is a bold and simple account about who God is and how he created our world. If the unbeliever calls it simplistic and naive, that's fine. They are bound to see it that way. But to the believer, this text is a treasure of truth about God and his awesome work of creation. It is a text that is meant to instill within us not only an appreciation for the world around us as the handiwork of God, but a love for the Creator himself. And so we continue on today looking at the second and third days of creation, verses 6 through 13 in our text. And we'll have three simple subheadings this morning. The first thing that we're going to look at is the concluding phrase of verse 5 and the pattern which it begins. the evening and the morning were the first day. And so that's our first point, the evening and the morning. Our second point will appropriately be the second day of creation, and our third point will be, you guessed it, the third day of creation. And so let's begin with this evening and morning. Now, as I said, beginning at verse 5, there's a pattern that gives the creation account its main structure. The evening and the morning were the first day. And then throughout the rest of the chapter, six separate days of creation are delineated, each defined in its length by evening and morning. Now, on day one, God created light, and he divided it from the darkness. He called the light day and the darkness night. And so the pattern of night and day is established even before the sun and the moon were created. As we saw last week, God did this to demonstrate that the day and the night are his creations and not simply some phenomenon of nature. The sun is created on day four to perpetuate this pattern of night and day as a matter of providence. But in God's wisdom, he chose to give us just a glimpse of a world in which night and day are immediately given by him. We do well to remember that creation is a miracle. Exactly how there can be evening and morning without sunrise and sunset is not something that we have to explain. It is something for us to marvel over and to ask what it teaches us about God and his wisdom. The church father Augustine rightly said that besides the resurrection, creation is the greatest miracle that God has ever performed. We believe that Christ rose again from the dead, but not because we have a scientific explanation for how that can be true. It was a miracle. It was a work of God that defies our experience and our expectations. So is the first day of creation, with its morning and its evening. It is a marvelous work of God that defies our limited experience. Now, much of the controversy that surrounds the doctrine of creation centers upon this point. What exactly are the days of creation? Some would say that they are long ages of time. Others say that they are just a literary framework instead of literal days. We're going to take a few minutes to try to explain, at least briefly, these two different viewpoints. But first of all, we need to ask the question, a more fundamental question, and that is, why does it even matter? If Christians can all simply agree that God created all things, why do we have to spend time arguing over different viewpoints of Genesis 1? Well, it matters for two simple reasons. First of all, it matters because the gospel of Jesus Christ begins on this page. It begins in Genesis chapter 1. The God of redemption is also the God of creation. And part of our witness to the world is that God created all things, and that only the Bible gives a clear and accurate account of how he did that, how he created our world. And so we have to ask the question, how can we confidently declare the gospel of salvation if we are in doubt over the doctrine of creation? Our faith and our witness call for clarity and conviction when it comes to the doctrine of creation, especially in our time, in our day and age, when competing theories of secular science seem to rule the day. If we equivocate on the first page of the Bible, then we will not stand fast on the rest of it. Secondly, it is a matter of biblical authority. There are many theories on Genesis chapter 1 that either defy the plain meaning of the text or make it so complicated that only the so-called experts can understand it. It's all too common to claim that the creation account, in some way or another, does not really mean what it says. Now, the liberals and the neo-Orthodox have been doing this for years, but sadly, it's now quite common in the evangelical world to play this game with Genesis 1. But how we interpret Genesis 1 is a question of how we perceive the Bible's clarity and authority, and it will influence how we read everything thereafter. Now, as for some of the alternate views on the days of creation, We first note a viewpoint that's often called the day-age theory. This perspective says that the days of creation were really long ages of time. And of course, that would accommodate the claims of modern science regarding the age of the earth. And proponents of this theory talk about how the word day is used in different ways, how it can mean a 24-hour period, or it can mean a long span of time. Even in our own language, sometimes we talk about, you know, back in the good old days, or back in my day, something like that. When day doesn't really mean day, it means a time period or an age. And they say that creation is broken up into six long ages. But this is clearly a crafted accommodation to secular science that is biblically unsustainable. It is true that day can mean age, but it never matters what a word can mean. It only matters what a word does mean in its context. Context gives words definite meanings. And if that were not true, we wouldn't even be able to communicate intelligibly. Now, in our text, the context clearly defines what is meant by the word day. The first day and every day thereafter is delineated by evening and morning. The Bible is using terms that are common to our experience. A day, a 24-hour span of time as we know it, includes a morning and an evening. Ages don't begin with a morning or end with an evening. But on the first day, God created the first day. The light and the dark he called day and night, and he divided them, creating evening and morning. This is not an age, but a day, which is clearly the plain sense of the text. Furthermore, the fourth commandment is rendered senseless if the creation days are ages. The commandment to work 6 days and rest on the seventh day is directly built upon the pattern that God set at creation. But to work for 6 ages and rest on the seventh age is an example that is useless to us. The day-age theory, however, is falling a bit out of style. And it's being replaced by something new, something that many people refer to as the literary framework theory, which is becoming more and more popular, even in Reformed circles. Even in Reformed seminaries, many students are taught this. This theory is incredibly complicated, but basically it has 2 points. The first point is that the days of creation are not really literal days. Instead, they are a literary construct. The days are just a framework to describe 6 creative acts of God. And these acts are divided into groups that correspond to each other. They would say that day 1 and day 4 correspond to each other with the creation of light and the luminaries. Day 2 and day 5 correspond to each other with the creation of the firmament and the waters, with the fish and the birds. And then day 3 and day 6 correspond to each other with the creation of vegetation and dry land, and then animals and man. 3 categories of realms, and then 3 utilizers of those realms. And so the whole scheme is just a literary construct that does not tell us exactly how or how long it took God to create all things, nor does it really give us a chronological order. It simply arranges the elements of creation into a literary construction. Now, the second element of this theory is very abstract and esoteric, and I wouldn't drag you through this unless it were very important, because this is one of the main things that's being taught to people today, to seminarians coming out and preaching in our pulpits, and things that people hear from the pulpit. This is one of the theories that's very popular today. Part of this theory is called something, and here's a new word you can impress your friends with, a two-register cosmology. Basically, the theory is that there is this visible world and an invisible world, an upper register and a lower register. And the act of creation takes place in this upper realm, in this invisible realm, and it has some kind of correspondence in the lower realm. All Genesis 1 is telling us is that there is some reality of which we know very little, which takes place in the invisible world in the upper register, but has some kind of effect below that we can see only through the metaphorical language of the 6 days of creation. But the 6 days themselves are not anything to be taken literally. Now, this kind of theorizing is very far removed from the simple narrative of Genesis chapter 1. In fact, what is most striking about this text before us is just how simple and straightforward it is. God does not speak to us in mysterious language that only the experts can understand. He does not use such intricate literary constructs so that the average reader is baffled. He does not talk about a two-register cosmology, and he does not use the word day when he really doesn't mean day. You see, God wants his people to understand how he created all things. It's not meant to be a riddle or some kind of mystery that we are supposed to solve. We need not overcomplicate what God tells us with such simplicity. Is it so hard to believe that the God who has the power to create chose to create in 6 literal days? Now, sure, Genesis 1 contains its mysteries, and it does not answer every question that we may think to ask. But for centuries upon centuries, the church has believed the plain meaning of this text and has always believed in 6 literal days of creation. Now, if the days of creation are really long ages, or if they are really just literary figures, then the church has been deceived for centuries until the experts came along in the past few generations so that they could enlighten us. If the 6 days of creation are not literal days, then this text is at best misleading and at worst deceptive. The primary impression that it makes on the average reader is that this act of creation took place in 6 days, each day defined by morning and evening. And so the simplicity of this text is not a deception, and the reality of creation need not be more complicated than the language. We must conclude, as the church has for centuries, that the days of creation are literal days, with morning and evening to mark their coming and going. Now, much more can be said on that subject, but it is an important one. And if it seems like a technical one, it's much more practical than you may think at first, because, as I've said, this is one of the main assaults on the scriptures today. It comes in the form of these different kinds of theories on Genesis 1. Well, let's turn our attention now to the second day of creation, verses 6 through 8. And we'll take just a moment to look at those verses again and read them. Then God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters." And thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And so the evening and the morning were the second day. Now here on the second day, God created the expanse that separates the earth from what is beyond. The firmament is the visible heavens, where it is the atmosphere that surrounds the earth. It's what you see when you look up, and it's also what you live in every day. It's fascinating that one whole day of creation is devoted to the creation of the atmosphere which surrounds the earth. And it is a very unique thing, if you think about it. As far as we know, there is no other planet with such a buffer between it and the rest of the universe. So Genesis 1 takes into account the atmosphere in which we live, the atmosphere that separates the earth from everything else beyond. And that really is a unique thing when it comes to the biblical creation account. Other ancient creation myths and stories don't even show any cognizance of there being anything like an atmosphere around the world. But here it was God's handiwork on the second day. Now, some have said that these verses picture the ancient notion of a vast sea that is up there beyond the sky, since the firmament is said to divide the waters above from the waters below. But this language is only in keeping with other biblical descriptions of God having a storehouse of rain in the heaven or treasuries of snow in the skies. The water on the earth invariably makes its way into the heavens, and it falls again on the earth in the form of rain. Thus, the firmament is said to divide the waters above from the waters below. This is not simply a naive ancient view of the world. It is a poetic but accurate description of how our ecosystem works. This interplay between the waters above and the waters below, what we call the water cycle, seems to be reflected in the Hebrew words for water and sky, mayim and shemayim, respectively. The Hebrew word for firmament also deserves a little bit of notice here. The verb form of this word means to beat out metal or to pound out metal into a shape. The noun itself, the noun that's here translated firmament in our text, in Hebrew is a reference to something that is pounded out like a bowl, a beaten copper bowl or a dome, something that a craftsman might make, pounding out something into a shape. It seems that the firmament is pictured as like a dome over the earth. And this verb is again used to describe the creation of the skies in Job chapter 37. That long list of rhetorical questions that are posed to Job, one of them is, have you spread out the skies strong as a cast metal mirror? And what's translated spread out is this verb, terkia, in Hebrew, and it means to pound out something. So I would translate, have you pounded out the skies strong as a cast metal mirror? The imagery of these verses portrays the firmament as something strong, something pounded out like metal, something like a dome surrounding the earth. And it's very fascinating imagery. On the one hand, it's the imagery of craftsmanship. As God creates the firmament, he's like a craftsman who pounds out this dome over the earth. He creates something with care and detail as a craftsman would. On the other hand, the earth's atmosphere is in fact like a strong dome that separates the earth from everything else that is beyond. Our text goes on to say that God named the firmament heaven. And the reference here is to the visible heavens, which we can see, which are part of creation. It's not a reference to that inscrutable dwelling place of God. There is a heaven where God is particularly present and where the angels and the glorified saints worship him. The Bible pictures the heavens that we can see as the gateway to the heavens in which God dwells. And so the firmament is called heaven, and God's dwelling place is called heaven. In this way, the skies above us that we always see are a constant reminder to us that God is infinite and transcendent. Jesus taught us to pray, "Our Father who art in heaven." We need to be reminded of God's transcendence when we pray, and we should also be reminded of this when we see the heavens that God has created. The vast beauty of the heavens that we see above us is only a faint reflection of the unapproachable glory in which God dwells. Now, the heavens above are meant to have another effect upon us as well. Psalm 8, which we will sing a little while later, says this, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him?" The vast beauty of the heavens made the psalmist feel small. By contemplating the heavens and the greatness of the God who could create them, the psalmist was filled with the sense of humility that drove him to worship. He wondered that such a great God could be mindful of such a small thing as him. The heavens above are to have that same effect upon us. We, like the psalmist, must take time to consider God's handiwork, consider what he has done, that dome that he has placed above our heads, and to appreciate the beauty and the immensity that lies above us. It helps us to grasp something of the power and the transcendence of God, and it helps to join humility to our faith. Look at the heavens above and consider what kind of God could create and rule over such a vast expanse, and you will begin to have a proper sense of what a humble creature you are. And like the psalmist, you can marvel and rejoice in the fact that such a God would not only take notice of you, but that he would actually show you his saving love in Christ. Now, one last thing remains to be said here on the second day of creation. On the first day of creation, God's speaking was the act of creating. He said, "Let there be light," and there was light. That's called an illocutionary act, by the way, whenever you speak something and the spoken word accomplishes the intention. That's what God did on the first day. Notice, however, here in verse 6, God speaks. He says, "Let there be a firmament." But then in verse 7, it says, "And God made the firmament and divided the waters from the waters." And the same is true in day 5. He speaks first. He says, "Let there be." And then immediately after, he creates the very thing that he said, "Let there be." It may be a point that you might not take second notice of, but Matthew Henry pointed out something that quite an astute observation. He pointed out that when God commands something to be and then he creates it, there is a correspondence to that in the realm of redemption, where he commands faith and then he gives the very thing that he commands. In our text, he simply commands the firmament to be, but the firmament can't obey the command. It can't create itself. God creates the very thing that he commands. In terms of our salvation, the same is true. God commands us to believe, and yet we can't believe on our own. We can't create faith within our hearts. The thing that God commands us to have is the very thing that he creates within us. And so there is this interesting correspondence in the work of God's creation and the work of our salvation. When God commands something, he himself gives or creates the very thing that he commands. Let's move on to verses 9 and 10 and the separation of the land and the sea. Verses 9 and 10. "Then God said, 'Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear.' And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good." Now, we saw all the way back in verse 2 that the primeval earth was simply a watery mass without any distinction between land and sea. And here God causes the land masses to emerge, and he creates a boundary for the ocean. Now, later scripture develops this act of God quite a bit more and pictures it as one of his mightiest works. That is specifically setting a boundary for the ocean and saying, "Here you must stop." For instance, Psalm 104 says this: "You who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should not be moved forever, you covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the voice of your thunder, they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys, to the place which you founded for them. You have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth." And so there is this poetic expansion upon this one act of God at creation. And just one more example from Job 38. And again, that long list of rhetorical questions that Job is peppered with. One of them is this: "Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I fixed my limit for it, and I set bars and doors, when I said, 'This far you may come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop.'" And so to shut in the sea and to define its limits is seen as one of the greatest acts of God's power. The restraint of the sea is something that we casually take for granted, but when it spills over its boundaries in God's providence, say in a flood or in a tsunami, we are reminded what divine power it takes to set the limits and to dictate the motions of the sea. Now, from this one act of God on day 3 of creation, The Bible develops a very important theme. The sea is always pictured as this powerful and unruly force of nature that only God can contain. And as such, the sea becomes a poetic picture of the raging nations and of the sinful mass of humanity. This metaphor is found dozens of times in the prophets and in the Psalms. And both Daniel and Revelation picture the pagan empires of the world as emerging from the sea, that tumultuous sea. If you think of it, it is a powerful metaphor. The sinful mass of fallen humanity is always in turmoil. It's always raging. It's always testing its boundaries, just like the sea. But God's power to contain the sea and to set its limits is also the power that God wields to restrain the raging nations. We can take comfort in knowing this, that no matter what evil happens on the earth, no matter what nations rise and fall, no matter what hardships there may be to face, God has set his limits. The sin of mankind is restrained by him until the day of judgment. Just as he set limits for the surging sea, there are limits that he will not allow evil to transgress. Now, this power of God to command the sea once again came to full display in the scriptures in Matthew chapter 8, when Christ was in a boat with his disciples. When the winds picked up and the waves became violent, Christ rebuked the sea. He commanded it, and it obeyed him. His disciples asked, "Who can this be that even the wind and the seas obey him?" The answer should be obvious. By this miracle, Christ showed that he is the same God who first showed his power to command the sea in Genesis chapter 1. Now, finally, the last act on day 3 was the creation of vegetation. And for that, we'll look at verses 11 through 13. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And so the evening and the morning were the third day. First, we notice that something is different here in the way that God creates vegetation. We already noted that when God created light, he simply spoke it into being. "Let there be," and it was. And then we noted when he made the firmament, he commanded it, and then he created it. Well, here we find yet a different method of creation. Instead of simply creating vegetation, God calls it forth from the earth. He said, "Let the earth bring it forth." And so, in this act of creation, the earth is made fertile. It is empowered by God to bring forth all the vegetation that covers it. This is no less an act of creation. But it's clear that God sets in motion a process in which the earth will always be fruitful and bring forth the vegetation, the plants, and the trees according to their kind. And so we see that fertility, which was so often deified by pagan religions, is an endowment given by God to the earth. Now, this language of the earth bringing forth vegetation is mirrored again later on in the text in verse 24, where the same is said of the animals, where it said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind." And so what we have is the earth bringing forth vegetation, the earth bringing forth living creatures. Some people have said that this kind of language allows for evolution, that it's a natural process for life in all of its variation to simply spring from the earth, to be the product of the earth over time. Well, the purpose of this wording is not to drop some cryptic evolutionary hint for modern science to pick up on. It simply shows us that the plants and the animals are very closely tied to the elements of this world. God even created man out of the dust of the ground. So the earth and its creatures have this mutual dependence and a common creator. Besides, the language of this text specifically refutes evolution in one important way. It says that God created each plant and later each animal according to its kind. There are original natural species that are differentiated from each other at creation rather than evolving from each other over time. Now, all of the various kinds of flora and fauna that cover the earth are simply divided into three categories: grass, herbs, and fruit trees. These are general categories, of course, but they are ones that seem to be directly related to the benefit of mankind. After all, think of how many thousands of kinds of trees there are in the world, but only fruit trees are mentioned. And that is because they are of direct benefit and blessing to man. Once again, we have to note that in every step of creation, God is ordering and preparing this world as a habitation for you, for mankind. It is perfectly suited to our needs to be a habitation for us. And so, contrary to much anti-biblical opinion today, man is not an intruder on this earth. Man is not the destroyer of this earth. God crafted the earth for us, for our use, and it's perfectly suited to that intention. Now, it is sad to note that the impact of these verses is somewhat lost on our urban culture. The earth bringing forth its bounty of good things and its many plants that provide food is a magnificent process that reminds us of the goodness of God as the giver of life in His created world. But it is a process that most people now rarely see, much less appreciate. When Adam was created, he was created and put in a garden and commanded to tend that garden. And so this object lesson was always before him. And most people in human history have been farmers of some kind. And so the many lessons that God has seen fit to attach to this magnificent process that He set in motion at creation, all of the lessons that He saw fit to attach to this process, everything from His work of creation to the New Testament, to the parable of the sower and the parable of the mustard seed, these things always had an anchor of illustration in the daily life of man, when men cultivated the ground and grew the plants that God created. Now farming is a science. Our food is grown for us in faraway places, and we buy it in the store with our coupons and our credit cards. But there are blessings, of course, to this kind of technological progress. Not much is obvious. But we have lost something as well. We have lost the spiritual object lessons that are embedded in the process of cultivating the earth and watching God create food from the ground for us. And maybe that's why we waste as much food as we eat, because we no longer appreciate the divine process by which it's given. God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind." Every blade of grass, every apple on a tree, every plant that brings forth something good for man to use grows because God commands it to be so. It is an important lesson to learn, an important lesson to see and to remember. And so this may be just about the oddest sermon application you have ever heard, but here it is. It is good for the soul to be a part of this process, even in some small way, and to do something as simple as to plant a garden. In the sterile little environments that we create for ourselves, we suffer a lack of connection to creation. We know that food grows from the ground, and we know that God made it to be that way. But we ourselves barely even have the experience of a process that is so fundamental to God's created order. God made Adam, the first man, to cultivate the ground. This is man in his most basic element, with this lesson of creation always before him. And God made it to be so. It is good for the soul to have at least some experience of this, to have some experience and connection to the earth of cultivating it and seeing God's creative work spring up from it. It is good for the soul to get the hands dirty and to realize that God not only creates food from the earth for you, but that you yourself were made out of the dust of the ground. And those are humbling lessons. When you run your fingers through the dirt and you see that dirt on your hands, you realize God made me out of that. And God brings life out of that and grows food out of that for me. It is humbling to see how truly dependent you are on God and His creative work from day to day. When God divided the waters above from the waters below, when He created the firmament, when He commanded vegetation to spring up from the earth, this is not all something that we are just supposed to watch happen on the Discovery Channel. This is the world that you are to experience and to appreciate and to be a part of. It is a world that is literally full of the evidence of God's goodness and God's power. It is a world that should humble you. It is a world that is full of mystery and wonder. It is a world that should drive you to worship. Everything around you declares the creatorship of God and His nearness and His goodness. Now, in conclusion, I want to ask you, have you ever given a gift to a child, maybe your own child or a grandchild or someone, and maybe an expensive toy, something that you think the child is going to like? Planned the gift, you bought the gift, you wrapped the gift, you know the child's going to like it. You give the gift to the child. The child opens the gift, looks at it, tosses it to one side, and he plays with the box. You know what I'm talking about. Well, we are a lot like that in many respects. God has created this incredible world, and He has made us a part of it. The sun shines and the rain falls for your sake. The plants, the trees grow for your sake. The whole creation declares His glory and His goodness. And what do? We play with our iPads, we eat our TV dinners, and we watch American Idol. And then we wonder why we don't sense the presence of God in our lives. We need to stop playing with the box and learn to appreciate the gift. We need to appreciate and take part in the world that God has created instead of trying to create our own little worlds. The world that God created is designed to declare His glory. It is designed to draw you closer to Him. This is not just a sentimental appreciation for nature. Lots of people have that. But it is part of the Christian life to be a thoughtful, worshipful participant in the order of creation. Let me say that again. It is part of the Christian life to be a thoughtful, worshipful participant in the order of creation. And so in conclusion, think about what we went over today, the second and the third days of creation. God made the firmament, or the heavens above us, and He gathered the waters into one place. These two specific acts of God are turned into a call to worship in Psalm 33. Psalm 33, verse 6. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of His mouth. He gathered the waters of the sea together in a heap, and He lays up the deep in storehouses. And then, what is the application of this? What is the conclusion? Without skipping a beat, without taking a breath, the psalmist says this: let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of Him. For He spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. A God so powerful that He created the heavens above us and He contains the seas is a God that should be feared and honored and worshiped. That is how to respond to God's mighty acts of creation. Let's bow in prayer.